what is Kansas going to be in 20 years? What is Kansas going to be in 30 years?
I didn't think Sam Brownback would be so relevant in a state race at this point.
I go to sleep every night with this like mantra in my head: school funding, taxes, healthcare. School funding, taxes, healthcare.
The race to the Kansas midterm elections is heating up. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPER Presents, Kansas journalists weigh in on the midterm elections and highlight key races across the state. It's the 2018 Journalism and Politics Lecture at the University of Kansas Dole Institute of Politics. This event featured Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service, Caroline Sweeney with KCTV in Kansas City, Hunter Woodall with the Kansas City Star, and Mary Clarkin with the Hutchinson News. This panel was held on September 11th, 2018, and was moderated by Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute.
I want to start with a question about how you approach your craft. What have you been doing to cover the midterm elections? And what does your average day look like when you're out on the trail covering the election?
I'll start. So for television, especially in an age where we can all get news 24 hours a day.
Caroline Sweeney is a reporter with KCTV5 in Kansas City.
What I've been trying to focus on, especially over the last several weeks, is how do I strike an appropriate balance between giving our viewers in Kansas City the news that they need to know, but not oversaturating them or overburdening them when they have a limited amount of time to actually sit down and tune in to our newscasts. I also know that not everyone is like us in this room, and politics might not fascinate them as much as it does me or my producers and the managers in our newsroom. So I have to be very aware that the news of the day may not be politics. So for the last month, I've been trying to come up with a plan to succinctly cover the races that we've decided our viewers need to keep an eye on, and planning things out so that in case something comes up, we have some breathing room to cover that breaking political news. And if it's been a few days since we've heard from that candidate, I have them available to tap into.
Jim McLean is managing editor of the Kansas News Service.
That's a good question, because I think you've assembled a good team, good panel here, because I think we all approach this differently. I remember when I was working for a daily newspaper, I mean, there wasn't really any development in a campaign that was too small to write 40 inches about. You just did it. But now, I'm in public radio, so there is no other news other than public affairs and politics.
Of course.
That's our proverbial bread and butter. But we're trying to then approach it on multiple platforms, if you will. There's a real emphasis in public radio now, from NPR on down, an emphasis on the digital stuff, the online, what essentially is an online version of newspaper stories. So we're trying to get better at that, and we're working with a lot of radio reporters who've been radio reporters and having to bring them along in that regard. But we've decided we're going to do a one weekly conversation every week, a kind of a round table of reporters like NPR does, just to catch up on the smaller things that are developing in the campaign so we don't miss any of those things, and also then don't have to blow them out of proportion in any way. And then one thing I'll do a little proselytizing here. We've been working on a new podcast called My Fellow Kansans that debuts on September the 17th, and we'll do a weekly update right on through Election Day. And the whole point of that is to try to get deeper into Kansas politics. The first episode, we literally get into the DNA of Kansas politics, and we spend a lot of time talking about Bob Dole, among other people, and try to talk a little bit about where Kansas has been in its history, where we have come to at this point, and why we're here rather than someplace else.
I'll just say my colleagues here are a lot more strategic than I am.
Hunter Woodall is a political reporter with the Kansas City Star.
So I'm the Kansas State House reporter for the Star. So essentially since January, the start of the session, I kind of feel like I've been running a marathon race at a 200-meter pace. I wake up every morning to, if the president has tweeted a lot, I get all the tweets sent to my phone, so I don't need an alarm clock anymore. it's essentially, there's so much going on at once. I mean, you could really be drowning in news right now. So, for example, today I had a story published that showed only 58% of Republicans in the legislature who are going to be on the ballot in the fall and in the state Senate support Kris Kobach's nomination for governor. And by 7:30 in the morning, I was already getting angry text messages from a state representative about the story. People are just, you know, I think it's that balance of, you know, you need to keep going, but you also need to make sure how your stories are resonating. And just when you talk about, you know, I'm a political reporter, I wrote mostly political stories, but the nice thing is, again, I'm a nerd, I'm a huge political nerd. And I think about, I go back to, okay, I listen to a story, this matters to me because I'm a little bit wonky, but I think back to my family, okay, if, you know, would my mom, would my grandparents want to read this story, does it interest, you know, your average reader? And that's kind of how I was maintaining my perspective. In an election like this with so much going on, I think it's crucial just to think, okay, how does this relate to just, you know, people on the street, people that you know? Is it more than just yourself?
Hunter, I guarantee you that prior to the primary, there wouldn't have been 58%. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, that we can talk about that dynamic.
Yeah. And as a reporter at a small regional paper, I also cover education.
Mary Clarkin is a reporter with Hutchinson News.
So politics and government will not be something I do on a daily basis. And I will say also that it kind of depends on where you're at. And in Hutchinson, there's only going to be one contested Kansas House race. And so different areas of the state will have more races going on than Western Kansas, for sure.
Okay. I'd like all of you to comment on what you think some of the key state issues are, you know, in the gubernatorial race, but also the legislative races.
So, you know, I covered the first gubernatorial debate last Wednesday in Overland Park. Obviously, there was a state fair debate on Saturday. It was interesting. There's kind of been, in the governor's race, a relitigation of the Sam Brownback tax cuts. Is Chris Kobach, he wants to roll back the 2017 tax increase, you know, that essentially ended Brownback's tax cuts. He also wants to roll back the sales tax increase of 2015, and he wants to change how they appraise homes. And that would, if without cutting, that could, you know, really crater the budget. And you have Laura Kelly on the other end who does not want that to happen. So, and of course, Greg Orman has kind of maintained more of that side of, I'm not a member of both parties. I'm not a member of either party. Both parties have really done a poor job running the state. So on the state level, it's kind of become a relitigation of Sam Brownback, oddly enough, even though, you know, he's long gone and in D.C. at this point. And it's, I didn't think Sam Brownback would be so relevant in a state race at this point.
I think I can, I go to sleep every night with this like mantra in my head: school funding, taxes, healthcare, school funding, taxes, healthcare, because those are the three big talkers that I hear from candidates and from citizens. So are the candidates getting it from the citizens, or are the citizens getting the rhetoric from the candidates? But it's, you know, taxes, school funding, healthcare. And then the other one that keeps coming up, especially now after what happened in Johnson County with the vote totaling issues, a lot of people are concerned about their voting rights and if their votes are being counted and the access to proper voting machines and voting outlets. So I've started to hear that come around over the last several weeks too.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is going to be, whether you're talking about taxes, the budget, spending, anything else, you hear Greg Orman talk, and all the candidates are addressing this to some degree or another. It's, you know, what is Kansas going to be in 20 years? What is Kansas going to be in 30 years? And, you know, you're not going to get a lot of long-term thinking in campaign rhetoric. And let's face it, a lot of this is style over substance. I mean, if you look at, and this isn't a criticism, if you look at Chris Kobach, you know, he's got kind of a mantra, he's got kind of a script, and he's going to, and what people like about him is it doesn't vary, okay? He just says the same thing over and over again. People can come at him all they want, and he's just going to say it over and over again. And yet, if you dig underneath that a little bit, I mean, he does talk about revisiting the tax cuts. He says the one mistake that Sam Brownback made was that he didn't cut spending before he cut taxes. And it's a nice rhetorical line, but if you press him on it and you say, okay, you're going to cut spending, then you're going to cut taxes, how are you going to cut spending? And his comeback on that is, I've cut the budget in the Secretary of State's office, which is like four, you know, a pittance compared to the state government.
Yeah.
And he says, we're going to do it through attrition. We're just going to let people leave, and we're not going to hire their replacements. Well, I think Kansans, frankly, have seen a lot of that over the last 8 years in terms of offices closing all over the state, you know, social welfare offices over the state. You know, counties are going from one place where you can go get your driver's license renewed to, you know, from 2 to 1. So we'll see how that works over time, but that's his answer on that. On the other hand, Greg Orman the other day very pointedly to Laura Kelly criticized her. She's going to revitalize the transportation plan, but she's not saying how she's going to pay for it, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, par for the course in terms of campaigns. But you guys are right in the sense that Kobach is a continuation. We're headed further right, red or red state if Kobach's elected. Kelly wants a stasis point in the middle, and I think Orman certainly is nearer Kelly than he is Kobach, but he's trying very hard to identify the differences between them.
Again, Mary Clarkin with Hutchinson News.
This Saturday at the Kansas State Fair in Hutchinson, they had a venue where politicians literally got up on a tree stump and spoke for 10 minutes and took questions.
Too.
Right. And the question that the politicians were asked the most, and it wasn't by the same person, different people, medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the issue. And then... And they didn't necessarily like what they heard from the stock answer seemed to be that, Attorney General Derek Schmidt said he liked the law as it is now.
Right.
And that got a boo.
Yeah.
So, but also the candidates, the issue that they spoke on more than education was Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So they hit that more than school spending.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that I did realize at the state fair, and it's good for especially reporters like Hunter and myself who are in a big metro on the eastern side of a very agrarian, large, sweeping plain state, is that there is a large voter base in agriculture and farming. And those weren't topics that were touched on, if I can remember correctly, in the Wednesday debate. But at the state fair, there were several questions about farming and agriculture. And it's good for us to remember that in the metro, because that, even though Kansas City is metropolitan, right outside Kansas City, even right outside of Lawrence, we see agriculture, business, big and small. So that, I think, will become part of the candidate rhetoric soon.
And Bill, that was an interesting thing because that used to be known as the ag debate at the Farm Bureau right. debate at the state fair, and immigration was an issue in that debate and in the context of agriculture. And it's going to be interesting to see what the Farm Bureau does with its endorsement. They endorse Collier in the primary. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a real tough time picking, I think, in the general, and may not endorse, because immigrant labor is so vitally important to farmers in western Kansas,
right.
and they're not sure they like Chris Kobach's position on that.
That's Jim McLean from the Kansas News Service. Just before that, Caroline Sweeney with KCTV5. If you're just joining us today on KPR Presents, it's the race to the Kansas midterm elections. Journalists from across the state weighed in on the issues and races to watch in the month ahead at this year's Journalism and Politics Lecture at the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas. Also on the panel, Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star and Mary Clarkin of the Hutchinson News. This event was moderated by Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute.
What are the factors that you see today that are going to decide the outcome of these midterm elections in Kansas? You know, typically we look at partisan ID as being, and presidential job approval doesn't affect, you know, localized races as much, but it still has some kind of effect. But beyond those traditional big factors in a midterm, what do you think are going to be the big factors that you're going to look to on election day to kind of read the tea leaves?
Yeah, we're all mulling this.
Is Patrick Miller still here? Let's
have yeah, him. Where is he?
Well, going back to the state fair on Saturday when they had the governor's debate, right before it was over, I was walking back through the fairgrounds, going through some of the buildings, and they were packed. So people who could have watched Kobach and Kelly and Orman on stage, just a matter of yards away, weren't. And this, and they were all ages. So I'm not sure what that tells you, but it could be a lower turnout despite all the heat that will be on the campaign trail.
I think Mary's going in an interesting direction with her comment. For me, what I'm finding when I'm out speaking to just Kansas Cityans is they're just apathetic to what's kind of going around them, despite our best efforts to try and shake them up and get them kind of rallied behind anyone, anything to get them energized. I think the oversaturation of news and trying to muddle through sometimes what's happening around them on social media and what they're hearing from you know, sources even in their own neighborhoods, that's really going to play a role. And that's what's always been the issue with midterms. We see time and time again, it's the base that goes and votes in these midterms, the very dedicated base. And that's what you were seeing at the state fair. The people that were in the shirts and yelling at the candidates and riling everyone up, that's the base. So I think that there is a concern that apathy may play a role, despite the fact we're hearing of more and more people running for office and more people wanting to talk about politics. It matters on that day when if you go and vote.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because we see increasingly in recent years, politics is, at this level, is getting nationalized to such a huge degree. And given what we see going on in Washington and the divide in the country, and you see voters being energized all over the country, particularly in congressional races, because, mm-hmm. you know, and so let's think a little bit about what happened in the 3rd District. You know, yep. why Sharice Davids won that primary in the 3rd District. And think about what was driving voter turnout over there. And again, I think there's some, you know, some national phenomena at work there. And so I think that there's energy at that level in terms of particularly those congressional races. The 2nd District race, I think, is going to be fascinating.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
Paul Davis, you know, who won that district in the race that he lost to Sam Brownback, even though Trump carried it significantly. And you have the 3rd District, which Hillary Clinton won by a mere percentage
yeah, 1%.
Point, right? And so I think that there's a great deal of interest in those races. And then the question is, I think in the governor's race, Kobach has a solid base, there's no doubt about that. And he's going to retain that base much in the same way that President Trump retains his base. And the question then is, I think the big question to answer in this race, because we have that 3rd candidate, Greg Orman, mm-hmm. he is a very comfortable point for a moderate Republican to end up. Mm-hmm. He's a refuge for moderate Republicans mm-hmm. who can't bring themselves to vote for a Democrat. You have plenty of people out there who, I think, frankly, fear a Kobach president. I mean, gubernatorial governorship. If they're moderate,
well,
I was skipping ahead because we all know that's where he's headed. But seriously, I think that there's that kind of fear factor, given what Hunter was talking about the Brownback legacy. And so, what are they going to do? What are those moderate Republicans in the NFL? First of all, can unaffiliated voters? Can anybody motivate them to come out? And what are the moderate? Where are the moderate Republicans going to end up? I think that's the thing to be watching on election night.
Sure. Well, and I will say, I think it's interesting. I go out and I cover protests, I cover rallies, and I also, a big thing I did in 2016 was, I like going out, obviously, with politicians, lawmakers, to events where they're interacting with constituents.
Again, Hunter Woodall with the Kansas City Star.
And if people won't let me come out with them, and there was one campaign, a Democrat campaign in the 3rd District, would not let me come out with them and kind of talk to voters with them. So I started going and canvassing. I would knock on doors where there was a sign for Jay Seide, Kevin Yoder's Democratic challenger, and I would say, why are you supporting Jay Seide? And more often than not was, well, he's a Democrat. There was nothing about him that they really mm-hmm. were voting for. And to me, 2016, in terms of those House races, was very apathetic. When I've covered, you know, even in the early stages, 2018, you know, in the 2nd congressional and the 3rd in the governor's race, I'm not seeing apathy. I mean, I've been covering rallies where I feel like people who have never gotten out are out there, and it seems like they're fighting for their lives almost. I mean, whether it comes to immigration or healthcare, I mean, again, I've only been doing this for about, you know, 5 years now, but they are so passionate, and that wasn't something I saw in 2016 as much. Now, of course, you know, in the 2nd and the 3rd, there are candidates on both sides. I think are, you know, there's a lot of passion for those candidates. The governor's race, I mean, Kris Kobach, when you talk to people that support him, they will bash through a wall for him. They adore him, and that's the thing that when you look at Orman and Kelly, you know, do they have that same thing? Because as you saw in 2016, somebody's saying, "Well, I can't vote for this person, so I guess I'll vote for this person." That doesn't really get you elected.
But that's not. I'm not. I get the chance to talk to people outside of the political circle when I'm not covering political stories who know that I also cover politics, so they want to talk about it. So I think what both Jim and Hunter are saying is true, that there are more people engaging, but I am just, you know, normal Joe Coffee in line with me at Quick Trip. They don't have this kind of, you know, the drive to go out there. They're still trying to figure out what they want to do. And some of them are just like, well, I just kind of want to stay out of it.
okay? Speak, if all of you would, speak to, and I want to ask a specific question about the Republican Party and then about the third party candidate that Jim mentioned. The Republican side, how split is the party? Not only just between Collier and Kobach, but also between moderates and conservatives. And how problematic is that for Kris Kobach?
Well, Hunter?
I had a big story on this today, actually, so thank you for that question. This took way too much work, so I don't know if I'll do it again, but I contacted every sitting GOP lawmaker in the House, in the Kansas House, and then every state senator, did the same for the Democrats, and said, are you going to support your party's nominee? So that was about 140 people I ended up contacting if they hadn't given endorsements yet. And the Democrats were fairly easy. About 94% said they would support Laura Kelly, the Democratic candidate for governor. I believe one wouldn't say, and then two wouldn't get back to me. On the Kobach side, I spent about 3 weeks either emailing, calling, and really just bugging the heck out of people to get them, which I like doing. It's kind of fun bothering people. And what I found was after, making those calls time and time again was, again, 58% of lawmakers say they'll support Kobach, and I believe 28% wouldn't say, and they actually, some of them grew really frustrated when I called, like, how dare you ask how I'm going to vote?
Right.
And I thought, you're an elected official. I mean, I can ask you, this is well within my rights to ask you this. And then close to 10% just did not get back to me, and that was a good amount of moderates who just didn't want to say. And so it was about 39% or so, close to 40, who would not say whether or not they supported Kobach. And if you're seeing in that division in the GOP itself, I mean, you have to think that goes down to voters. Because, I mean, these are lawmakers who will have to work with Kobach, presumably, and they're even this split. And I was fascinated by that. And we've seen, really since, for years, there's a large, there's that moderate faction of the GOP and there's that conservative faction. And I used to cover Missouri politics and Wyoming politics. Obviously, there's large Republican parties in those states. They don't have these same divisions. And Kansas has a very emboldened moderate party, very critical conservative party. I mean, when I asked a lawmaker on the conservative side how he felt about moderates not endorsing or not saying they support Kobach, I mean, I'm quoting him. I think he said, his quote was, they have no balls, no guts. That was his attitude. So you kind of see the fire in between those two groups.
I've got a couple names I'll throw out to illustrate how deep the divide is, I think. Barbara Boyer, for one, state senator from Mission Hills, who had the audacity to endorse a Democrat in the primary in the 3rd District Congressional race, and she was then excommunicated from her committees in the legislature. And then Bill Graves. I mean, I talked to Bill Graves for an hour the other day. It's funny, I got an interview with him after he came out and endorsed Laura Kelly. And Bill Graves, again, is the embodiment of moderate Republicanism, right? Very nice man, and I called him up and he was home, and I asked him how much time he had for the interview, and he said, well, we have two homes now, and Linda's in Florida with the horses, so how much time do you need? A couple hours? and he couldn't have been nicer, but I got an opportunity to really talk to him, and it was really clear to me in that conversation, what a struggle this was for him to do it, but how deeply he felt about what he was doing, because that split is pronounced. It has been. That tug of war has been going on for 30 years, and it ebbs and flows, but I think the divide is pretty deep right now. And again, that's why I think this Greg Orman candidacy is so important, because I talked to a guy like Ed Flendry. People know who Ed is, and he writes the column, he doesn't know who he's going to vote for, but we had a conversation about it, and a guy like Greg Orman appeals to him, and I think that's true for a lot of people who just aren't comfortable crossing the partisan line.
Right. Well, Hunter made a comment about, are we going to start seeing this divide kind of translate into voters? And I say, I think we're seeing it already. Just look at look at the Republican votes from the primary. 350 votes between 343.
Well, Jeff and Chris were counting.
You know, 343 votes separating the sitting governor and the secretary of state. But what fascinates me the most when you want to talk about how the moderates are feeling is when you look at the Ken Selzer and Jim Barnett votes. I want all I want to do is talk to people about Jim Barnett and Ken Selzer and those votes, because I think we were so fascinated by this very slim margin, and that's what a lot of people were talking about, but it became slim for several reasons, and one of those reasons was a self-proclaimed centrist named Jim Barnett. And I think he spoke to a lot of people, and he was palatable to a lot of these moderates that are like, I don't know how I feel about our sitting governor and this firebrand Republican. I like Jim Barnett, and I'm going to put my vote behind him. And I think they are the ones that really show the schism in the Republican Party.
Fourth episode of the podcast, The Red Pickup Truck. It's all about Jim Barnett and his campaign for governor.
We'll hear an episode of that podcast, My Fellow Kansans, later this hour. Today on KPR Presents, we're looking at the upcoming Kansas midterm elections with Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service, Caroline Sweeney of KCTV5, Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star, and Mary Clacken of the Hutchinson News.
Hutchinson had a very fiercely fought Kansas House race between moderate Republican Representative Steve Becker and conservative Republican Paul Wagner. And it ended up being Wagner won by 9 votes. But it got to the point where if you would go to a county Republican Party sponsored debate or meeting, you'd really only see the conservative Republicans there. So it's that the division is there and probably just grows deeper in an election year, but it's long-lasting.
And those folks who live in Lawrence know Scott Morgan, who ran for Congress, he ran for Secretary of State. Again, you know, moderate Republican, he's now trying to form a new political party because he just doesn't feel like the Republican Party is home to him anymore.
That sets up my next question perfectly, Jim. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We've had here at the Dole Institute in the last semester, and I hope some of you were able to catch the programs that Jim Jonas led, our discussion groups. Jim is a national strategist who was associated with the Kobach campaign in 14, and also Reed Galen, who is someone I know real well, who's the son of Rich Galen, who I worked with at the National Republican Congressional Committee on Fred Thompson's presidential campaign in 2008. And they have really devoted, there's an effort out there to build an independent movement now.
Right.
So this is my question about Greg Orman. Does he have, in your opinion, a legitimate chance to win, or is he a spoiler who's going to make it a three-way race and let Kobach basically win on his base vote?
The polls don't suggest that Orman has that strong of a chance, but it's still early, and kind of like you said, the moderate Republicans have to go somewhere, and that might be where they end up.
You know, I wish I had an. Obviously, I don't have an answer for that question now. He's gonna have plenty of money. He looked like he belonged on the stage at the state fair debate. He wasn't outclassed in any way, shape, or form. I think what the conventional wisdom is, Bill, to be pretty clear about it, is if he starts creeping up into the 11, 12, 13, even up to 15% range, that's really bad news for Laura Kelly if he gets that many votes, right? Does he have a path to victory? Most people who study politics and know it well say no. He doesn't have. You can't convince him of that, and that's as it should be. He's running for governor. He's on the line. He's out there campaigning, and he's decided he thinks he can win. A lot of observers, the pundits, do not think he can win, but they think it's very likely, should he catch any support at all and gets up into that 15% range, that could do exactly what you say and tilt the race to Kobach.
Today, I was asked twice what I think Greg Orman is going to do in this election, and I just want to see how it's going to play out, because I think that's really the only way we're going to know what a strong independent candidate like Greg Orman would do in a statewide election, because he is a strong candidate. He did give Senator Roberts a tough race, and overlooking that, just looking at him as a third party candidate, I think is detrimental to the role he's going to play in this election.
Well, of course, so you look at 2014, the Democrats, cleared the path for him. They,
right.
They essentially, he became the de facto Democrat candidate in a number
right.
of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key thing here is you have candidates, and I know we've all heard this over the years, that say like, oh, I'm not beholden to one party, you know, I'm my own person, I'm a free thinker, independent thinker. To win a campaign, you really do need that party infrastructure, because you need people to turn out the votes in these, you know, counties. Like, if you're Greg Orman and John Dahl, you know, as lieutenant governor candidate, how are you going to turn out votes in Western Kansas? I mean, you have political parties who have spent decades upon decades working on their turnout the vote, you know, ways. They know that they have that infrastructure in place, and that's the tough part with an independent. I mean, can you be an independent and just become governor in a state like Kansas? I'm not sure if that's possible, because you almost need this to go, you know, from the bottom bar. Like, you're winning city council seats, you're doing something like that, building this through the community. That infrastructure isn't there. I mean, if you want to go talk to a local club or something, a local party, meeting, Chris Kobach can just call up that local Republican in that county and say, hey, I want to go speak to them. What does Greg Orman do? And I think that's going to matter come election time, because you can get this much face time, but you need to reach the voters who are actually going to vote. Can Greg Orman do that? I'm not sure.
And Hunter, to your point, that's again, there's a difference between an independent candidate like Greg Orman and what Scott's trying to do, which is to create that party apparatus behind somebody who's not either a Republican or Democrat. Because he looked at that and didn't think that you could win unless you had that base of support underneath you there.
That's Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service. Before that, we heard from Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star, Caroline Sweeney of KCTV5, Mary Clacken of the Hutchinson News, and moderator Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute of Politics. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're previewing the upcoming Kansas midterm elections. We'll have more coming up right after this. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from you. Our biggest source of financial support comes from listeners. Whether you're listening in Lawrence, Emporia, Topeka, or online across the country, local programs like KPR Presents are only possible because you support them. Because you rely on KPR Presents for thoughtful conversations and information about Kansas politics, events, and culture, do your part to support it. Pledge now at 888-577-5268 or online at kansaspublicradio.org. And thanks. If you're just joining us, today on KPR Presents, we're previewing the upcoming Kansas midterm elections. It's the 2018 Journalism and Politics Lecture at KU's Dole Institute of Politics with Mary Clacken of the Hutchinson News, Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service, Caroline Sweeney of KCTV5, Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star, and moderator Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute of Politics.
Can I get the four of you to just share, as of today, understanding that we're still, you know, almost 2 months out, how would you handicap the gubernatorial election and the second and third congressional races?
Well, I'll start. I think Kobach, no matter what might come out, when you get closer to the election, the information that might come out damaging about any of the candidates, and I think he's, with his base, he's got a firewall, so he's safe from that. I don't know if Kelly or Orman enjoy that same safety net if something negative were to come out.
The most fascinating race for me outside of the gubernatorial race is this Kansas third race. Mm-hmm. I'm deeply fascinated by Sharice Davis as a candidate. I'm incredibly curious to see how Kevin Yoder continues. We saw him immediately hit back the day after the election with some advertising against her. And I was kind of thinking that it was going to be difficult for him to find another toehold. And he did with that podcast interview she did. Mm-hmm. So that's the race I'm most fascinated by outside of the gubernatorial race. But I think all of these races are extremely serious, and we have to look at them through that lens.
I think we're in such uncharted territory. Again, I take my thinking derives somewhat from looking at what's happening across the country, where there have been so many surprises, right? So we're in a different kind of year this year. And so normally, conventional thinking, again, particularly let's take the 3rd District as an example. Conventional thinking is that, you know, Yoder is a skilled politician. He's got an awful lot of money. And he is very good at ending up where he thinks he needs to be, you know. And that's not a clear anymore blue or red district. It's kind of split right down the middle, as evidenced by the last presidential race. So conventional thinking is that, you know, people came going in and say, you got to nominate a guy like Nierman, who's more centrist. He's one of those centrist Democrats who people will be comfortable voting for. But again, what you're seeing nationally suggests no. Guys like that don't create the energy you need. So there's an insurgency going on out there. I think you're right. I mean, the question is, does Sharice Davids catch that wave? Mm-hmm. I think that's the question. I think it's an open question right now. I don't know. But I think potentially, we're Kansas. It's a red state. And I don't know much about the Thompson Estes race down mm-hmm. in Wichita. I'm not counting that. But you know, potentially, 2 districts are in the state are in play for Democrats to win, the 3rd and the 2nd. I think if I had to bet right now, I would bet Paul Davis wins the 2nd district, because you had every county chair in the 2nd district, the Republican county chairs, come out against Watkins in the final week of the primary. And they can say they're united behind you now, but really? Really? I mean, that's a heck of a lot of fence mending that he's got to do, I think, to create the energy you need to win a campaign. You know, they'll sign something and they'll say, yeah, we're all united, but will they work for him? Really, nobody knows much about him. And so I think the 2nd district is truly in play. The 3rd district is a fascinating question. And then that governor's race, you know, I'll just keep saying it. If the Laura Kelly who showed up on the state fair debate stage, if you can keep that energy going through the campaign, I think I saw a real difference in her. I think she's got a chance. I think in a head-to-head race, if it were just Kelly and Kobach, I'd put my money on Kelly right now. But the Orman factor is confounding.
You've just heard Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service, Caroline Sweeney of KCTV5 in Kansas City, Mary Clacken of the Hutchinson News, and Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star. They spoke September 11, 2018 at this year's Journalism and Politics Lecture at the Dole Institute of Politics. This event was moderated by Bill Lacey, director of the Institute. For the rest of this hour, it's My Fellow Kansans from the Kansas News Service. Support for My Fellow Kansans comes from the Kansas Leadership Center, offering leadership development training in Wichita, Kansas City, Topeka, and online. Inspiring leadership for the common good. KansasLeadershipCenter.org.
Well, my fellow Kansans, here we are again, deep into an election season that virtually everyone agrees will be another decisive chapter in the tug of war over what Kansas should be.
I'm pumped, and I'm ready to get busy working on the general election.
Democratic nominee for Governor Laura Kelly, she's pumped in kind of an understated Kansas way, and so am I, because there's a lot on the line, some big questions. Will voters return Kansas to its practical progressive roots, lead us down a new independent path free of divisive party politics, or keep us traveling down the road we've been on for the last decade, that road to a redder red state? I'm Jim McLean, your guide for this running conversation about the 2018 election and the events that delivered us to this pivotal point. I've covered politics for public radio and newspapers for more than 30 years, and rarely have we had so much to talk about. This is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service.
From the start.
Yet another lie,
Commissioner.
From the governor.
Yes, this is a podcast about an election, but we won't spend a lot of time talking about who's up and who's down in the governor's race, or which of the candidates said the most outrageous thing on Twitter or otherwise.
It does look like it's at this point, a Kobach-Kelly smackdown.
Let's get underneath all that, dive deeper to explore the powerful but sometimes hidden forces that shape candidates, supercharge issues, and affect our elections. Still with me? Okay, good. On this first episode of My Fellow Kansans, we'll do a couple of things to kind of set the stage for what's to come in the coming weeks between now and Election Day. Some basic things, like introduce the candidates for governor. I'll do that in just a minute. But I also want to get into the DNA of Kansas and its politics. Not too deep, just talk a little bit about what makes Kansas, Kansas. You know, that stuff about its free state beginnings, its symbolic reputation as the real America. That black and white but welcoming, homey place that Dorothy and Toto want to get back to. That stuff is both imagined and real. It's all important to our politics. It's what native Kansan Thomas Frank trades on in his famous, or depending on your point of view, infamous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? A book in which he argues that a kind of reverse populism changed the state.
When What's the Matter with Kansas came out, I got a lot of criticism from people who thought, well, you know, your views are so odd, your politics are so out of the mainstream that you can't be a real Kansan. And the funny thing is, I feel like I am deeper in the Kansas grain than all of these right-wingers who rule us today because of that populist tradition. Those are my people.
Frank rarely does interviews these days about the book that put him on the literary map in 2004, but he talked to me about it, so of course I'll have a lot more of that conversation coming up. But before I get to that, let's dispense with the introduction of the main characters in this year's election drama, the candidates for governor, and talk about where they fit into Kansas's political traditions. Five candidates will be on the November ballot, including a couple of long shots. Jeff Caldwell is the Libertarian Party's nominee, and Rick Clues is a self-described frustrated Republican. He's running as an independent. The Democrat in the race, Laura Kelly, well, she's no long shot. She's a longtime state senator from Topeka.
I represent an urban area, but I also represent a lot of rural. And my Senate district is 10 points plus Republican. A Democrat has to appeal to all different kinds of Kansans. And I think we've been able to do that just because we have common sense, moderate, thoughtful approaches to public policy.
Kelly isn't the first Democrat to play it down the middle and put an emphasis on working across party lines. That's pretty much the Democratic playbook for Kansas. She's following in the footsteps of former governors like Kathleen Sebelius, John Carlin, and Bob Docking. He was a penny-pinching Ark City banker who occupied the governor's office for four terms in the 60s and the 70s.
Ladies and gentlemen, I consider this an austere but adequate budget.
Austere but adequate. It's a phrase you still hear around the State House during budget debates.
We share a joint responsibility to give our citizens quality services rendered effectively, efficiently, and economically.
Laura Kelly says stuff like that when she talks about the damage that, she says, former Republican Governor Sam Brownback's tax experiment did to the state.
Much of what makes Kansas so special has been under attack for the last 8 years. The cuts to our public schools have done harm to so many, and it was all to pay for tax cuts for those who needed them the least. It's wrong, and I'm running for governor to fix it.
Well, in 2018, so is Greg Orman.
It caused us to underinvest in our kids, our infrastructure, and by definition, our future. It led to two credit downgrades, a doubling of our debt, and punched a multi-billion-dollar hole in our budget. It was the definition of fiscal irresponsibility.
Orman is a wealthy business owner from the Kansas City suburbs who ran a decent but unsuccessful race for the U.S. Senate in 2014. He looks every bit the part of a traditional, moderate Kansas Republican, but he's not. He's running as an independent. He wants to break free of party rule and get back to more practical, less ideological politics.
The future is not found in the failed promises of partisans, but rather in the freedom and courage to embrace a new path. Because I want to go forward without the yoke of partisanship to a future that is good for all Kansans, I'm running for governor as an independent.
So, we've got an independent contender, Greg Orman, a viable Democrat, Laura Kelly, and then there's the candidate who's on Fox News so often he deserves his own time slot.
Chris Kobach is the Secretary of State of Kansas, and he joins us tonight. Mr. Kobach, thanks for calling up.
Great to be with you, Tucker.
That's the Republican nominee, Chris Kobach. In the GOP primary, he billed himself as the most conservative candidate in a field of conservative candidates. If elected, he'd keep Kansas headed right on Brownback's red state roadmap.
Issues. If I'm your governor of Kansas, you'll have conservative results. Number one, we will cut taxes. Number two, we will end illegal immigration in Kansas. Number three, we will protect unborn life in Kansas. And we will be the number one state in protecting gun rights in America.
Kobach is now the guy conservatives are counting on to continue their domination of Republican politics. He's been Kansas's Secretary of State for the last 8 years, and he's used that office to build a national reputation as a hardliner on illegal immigration and voter fraud. Kobach entered the GOP primary as the favorite, and he won, beating out incumbent Governor Jeff Collier, who stepped up when Brownback left for a job in the Trump administration. But Kobach's margin of victory in that primary was among the smallest in state history, a fraction of a percentage point, only 343 votes.
First and foremost, I want to thank the Lord above for carrying us through on this victory.
An endorsement that arrived via Twitter on the day before the election just might have been the difference maker.
Hartman and his wife, Libba. And in particular, I would like to thank the President of the United States, Donald Trump, for his endorsement both during the primary and again reiterated this morning with a tweet endorsing us in the general election cycle.
Kobach draws frequent comparisons to Trump because of his never-back-down style, and he likes that.
In it to win it in Kansas. You know, he's a great man. I think he's already making history as a president.
Kobach may be cut from the same conservative populist cloth as Donald Trump, what Thomas Frank calls reverse populism. But when it comes to Kansas's political DNA, he's an outlier. The state's center-right Republican tradition has been embodied by a pretty long list of Kansans who rose to national prominence. William Ellen White, Alf Landon, his daughter, Nancy Landon Kassebaum, Dwight Eisenhower, and, of course, this guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, delegates to the convention and fellow citizens, I cannot say it more clearly than in plain speaking. I accept your nomination to lead our party once again to the presidency of the United States.
Bob Dole, the Kansan who overcame terrible wounds suffered on a snowy Italian mountainside in World War II, to rise almost to the top of American politics. He, more than anyone else, says University of Kansas political scientist Burdette Loomis, exemplifies the particular strain of republicanism that dominated Kansas politics for so long.
Yeah, I think that you have a few people to look at, but I mean, I think the key practitioner over the course of the 20th century has been Bob Dole.
Dole, Loomis says, was a conservative who believed in containing government, not crippling it.
He didn't reject government, and you know, indeed, he was almost fatally injured working for the government in World War II. He was rehabilitated by the government. He lived in a farm area that needed government subsidies, on and on and on. Cut the great deal on food stamps and in the farm bill. And to me, he represents this kind of fairly conservative but not crazy republicanism.
American politics was just starting to harden when Dole captured the Republican nomination for president back in 1996. Compromise was becoming a dirty word, but not to Dole. He could be fiercely partisan, no doubt about that, but he made his reputation working across party lines to get stuff done. Things like the Americans with Disabilities Act and legislation that made it easier for millions of hungry Americans to put food on the table.
And to those who believe that I live and breathe compromise, I say that in politics, honorable compromise is no sin. It is what protects us from absolutism and intolerance.
That deal that Dole struck in the late 1970s with George McGovern, then one of the Senate's most liberal Democrats to preserve and reform the food stamp program, well, it continues to be held out as an example of how politics should work.
This bipartisan legislation revolutionized the program and made the program more efficient and more accessible to the poor by finally eliminating the requirement that Americans pay for a portion of their stamps.
If you didn't have, you know, that money to put up, then you weren't eligible for the program. It didn't make any sense to me.
That's Bob Dole, the original compassionate conservative, with all due respect to George W. Bush. Part of Kansas's political legacy also belongs to non-politicians, thought leaders like William Ellen White, the reform-minded publisher of the Emporia Gazette, who early in the 20th century was known as the Sage of the Heartland. He spoke out against the Ku Klux Klan when it wasn't a popular thing to do, and he championed several of the progressive causes of his friend, President Theodore Roosevelt. White believed an educated electorate was essential to a functioning democracy. He said a voter armed with knowledge of history and, quote, the fields of human activity, unquote, could be counted on to resist the inevitable siren song of the demagogue.
He will not mistake kindness for cowardice. He will not find himself suspecting everyone and believing everything, for curiously and paradoxically, the fool is always suspicious and credulous. Those two qualities go together.
Well, in case you didn't quite catch it, White, in that rare surviving snippet of tape from 1938, said the fool is always suspicious and credulous, a fancy word meaning gullible, naive, unwary. Depending on your point of view, you might see White's concern about gullible voters as prescient. So, what pushed Kansas politics to the right? There's no argument that it happened, but there's plenty of disagreement about how and why. Thomas Frank has wrestled with those questions. Coming of age in the affluent Kansas City suburb of Mission Hills, he was a devoted supporter of Ronald Reagan. But that changed soon after he set foot on the KU campus and discovered the massive Gothic structure known as Watson Library.
I remember wandering around in that library one day, and I came across an entire shelf of books with the same title. They were all the same volume, the same, you know. And it was The Populist Revolt. It was a book published in 1931 by a guy called John Hicks. Once upon a time, a famous history of populism. So I pulled one down and started reading it. And lo and behold, it's about Kansas. It's about stuff that happened here. And I had never heard of any of it before. A light went on in my head that has never gone off, which is that all of this kind of the populism of Reagan, the populism of the market, is this stuff that I'm reading about turned on its head.
Reverse populism, that's the thesis of Frank's book, which, remember, takes its title from one of William Allen White's famous editorials. Frank argues the seismic shift in Kansas politics was driven by politicians beholden to big business who use the populist power of cultural wedge issues, mainly abortion, to hoodwink working-class people into voting against their economic interests. There have been plenty of naysayers, but almost 15 years after the book's publication, Frank says he thinks that argument still holds up. I talked to him recently when he passed through Wichita promoting his latest book, a collection of essays called Rendezvous with Oblivion.
As our country, you know, went further and further down the road towards this free market paradigm, very predictable things followed. As you destroy organized labor, for example, the lives of working people suffer. Inequality grows. Small farmers get hurt. All of these things were absolutely predictable from the get-go, and here they were happening, and this is a democracy, and we were letting them happen. And not only were we letting them happen, we were voting for them. And so I needed a place to write about it, and I didn't want to do the South. And Kansas was perfect for a bunch of different reasons, because I knew about it. You know, I've obviously grew up here, very familiar with the state. It didn't have that Southern legacy, so you couldn't brush it off as a leftover of Jim Crow or something like that. And also because it had turned, or was in at that moment.
Turning.
Yeah. This is in the late 90s and early aughts.
Yeah, post-Reagan, but it was starting to turn.
Right, right, right. It was abandoning the sort of Dwight D. Eisenhower Republican Party and making its bid to be the Sam Brownback Republican Party. And I could watch it happen with my own eyes. It was fascinating. And the thing that triggered it, I was living in Chicago and I opened up the newspaper there, the Chicago Tribune or whatever, one day, and they had a big story about Kansas fighting over the theory of evolution. And I could not believe it, because that's not the state I grew up in.
Let's just make it clear, though, you didn't start from a neutral premise. You had made the conclusion that this turn toward unbridled capitalism was a mistake.
Absolutely. So I'm not acting as a neutral journalist in this. I never do. I think that's in like the first 10 pages of What's the Matter with Kansas. However, that said, the book is not a by-the-numbers attack on right-wingers. And I think that's what distinguishes it from – I mean, there's now an enormous body of work on this kind of subject, usually attacking, mocking, deriding the people who vote for right-wing candidates. And that is not what I did.
But he argued they'd been sold a bill of goods by politicians who made empty promises to turn back the clock on the cultural and economic changes that were rocking their world.
And that's where populism comes in, and the kind of reverse, the culture war right-wing populism that is everywhere around us today. But Kansas was, in some ways, was way ahead of the rest of America in this regard. You know how Trump and Bannon, and it's so cynical and manipulative, but they like to talk about the Republican Party becoming a workers' party. And that's what I described in Kansas way back when, and happening in the 1990s. Yeah. So the sort of party of Nancy Kassebaum, Bob Dole, Dwight Eisenhower, Bill Graves has slowly but surely become something very, very different.
I want to just go back to page 254 in your book here. And you talk about this, you label it backlash conservatism.
Yes, that's one of my term that I made up.
It says, the hallmark of backlash conservatism is that it approaches politics not as a defender of the existing order, but as an average working person offended by the arrogant impositions of the liberal upper class. The sensibility was perfectly summarized during the campaign by one-time Republican presidential candidate Gary Bauer, who explained it to the New York Times like this. Joe Sixpack doesn't understand why the world and his culture are changing and why he doesn't have a say in it.
Yeah, you've put your finger on the essential subject, that this is not a conservatism of complacency. It's not country club conservatism. It is a conservatism with a grievance.
You say frequently that people who are aggrieved by things, the degradation of our culture.
Well, what Gary Bauer says, he's exactly right. I disagree with Gary Bauer on every issue. But when he says Joe Sixpack wonders why his world is changing and he doesn't have a say in it, yeah, that is the story of our times. The world that we grew up in is disappearing. The sort of middle class society that we all loved, that I was born into in the 1970s or in the 60s, is vanishing before us. It's crumbling. And the conservatives have figured out a way to harness that anger without really doing anything about the economic basis of the grievance, about what's happened, what's actually happened. I mean, they make that much worse. That gets worse all the time, you know, as they cut taxes and defund the state and wreck unions and deregulate and all that stuff. That world that we were born into crumbles more and more and more.
As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people take issue with Frank. They believe there are other reasons for the shift from Landon and Dole to Brownback and Kobach. And we'll hear from them in later episodes. But there's virtually no disagreement on what set things in motion, what triggered the political changes in Kansas.
Friday, 8-2, approximately 8:19 a.m., Dr. Tiller's attempt to enter the clinic. Gate is blocked. The protesters have been informed.
1991 Summer of Mercy abortion protests in Wichita.
It was a huge deal. We never expected the crowd that came from all over the country to Wichita.
They had to bring out buses. They brought out rider trucks or rental vans one day because there were so many protesters to haul off.
We're going to continue to pray and we'll be here a little longer.
We're petitioning God. We're petitioning God to change the hearts of the people of this country.
They took control of the Sedgwick County Republican Party. They were out of the pews, into the streets, and then into the political arena.
The group plans to take its pleas all the way to the Democratic and Republican National Conventions next year.
The point that the Summer of Mercy changed the political landscape of Kansas is 100% true, and you're standing on the ground where it happened.
The prairie fire that ignited a conservative uprising in Kansas, next time on My Fellow Kansans.
My Fellow Kansans is a production of the Kansas News Service, a collaboration of KCUR, KMUW, Kansas Public Radio, and High Plains Public Radio. The podcast is written and reported by Jim McLean, edited by Amy Jeffries, and mixed by Matthew Long Middleton. The production team includes Beth Golay, Nadia Foe, Scott Cannon, and me, Grace Lotz. Primary Color Music composed our theme, and Jordan Kirtley designed our logo. Reporters Madeline Fox and Stephen Bisaha contributed audio to this episode. Special thanks to Neil Carruth of NPR and the NPR training team. If you liked this episode, subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find our podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KS News Service.
My Fellow Kansans comes to us from the Kansas News Service, a collaboration of public media stations across the state. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.